These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries, sending away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make the high-quality clothing staples you need for a comfortable, stylish, and active summer wardrobe, like vintage-style tees, breathable polos, lightweight sweatshirts, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country, and jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, a.k.a. Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Mr. McQuilkin, welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. I feel like I'm interviewing you for once.
Yeah, well, the tables will turn very quickly.
Thanks for being a guest.
A guest on Power Athlete Radio. We've crushed 10 years, over 700 episodes, and here we are to talk some fun training as we are reviewing books that started this whole thing. Now, 10 years later, with experience applying it to thousands of athletes all over the world and some in-person performance-based athletes, and making connections from the awesome words of Zatsiorsky and many others.
Yeah, no, I really think that you should be able to do periodic reviews. And I think doing a Q1 review makes a ton of sense. Things that we really looked at in, you know, February, March, April, May, June, I mean, all the way through January or through November and December. And now here we are finishing up Q1 into April. And I think it's time for a little bit of review, not only in the programs, what we've been doing with our athletes, and more importantly, what kind of things are really coming in and being pretty exciting for us.
Yes. And many of you have seen some fun training that we're doing with some professional jiu-jitsu fighters, players.
I call them BJJ players.
You jits. Call them that, or is that the norm? I just call them.
Well, there's like judo players, and we got that one from Ronda Rousey's mom. Mm-hmm. Kept referring to herself as a judo player, which I liked. It like kind of made me feel like a video game. So we could call them jiu-jitsu players, jits players, or just our jiu-jitsu kids, seeing as that we've adopted these lost orphans of strength conditioning.
Yes, and it's interesting now to view their performance on the line, but then seeing the gap between their general physical preparedness and then their awesomeness at their specific sport. And then over since September, seeing the bridge that we're able to connect by introducing basic compound movements, and gradually as their skill improves within the general movements, seeing how that's expressed in their specific sport. And it's only going to improve because the confidence, the strength, the stability within the weight room, it's increasing every time we get the opportunity to work with them.
The one thing that I observed when we first started training with them was a lack of rigidity in the ankles, especially for executing plyometric movements. So that was one of the first things we wanted to address. And the way I wanted to do that was actually with Polish boxes.
Yes.
I couldn't find anybody that one was selling Polish boxes. And I was asking a bunch of people to, hey, can you shoot me some measurements? Like, what's the pitch ideal? Is it 45? Is it 40? Is it 35? Just because I didn't want to have to go through the time to R&D a whole bunch of different boxes. Making them, no problem. But what I was looking for was a little direction. And I shot out about a Signal Flares and I got nothing in return. It was like crickets. So I ended up coming across the Weck method and David Weck and the Weck boards that we've been using. And they actually offer different slants. And what I liked about them is the slants are all different wherever you are on the board. So I'm constantly putting them on different parts of the board to try to figure out where they're stronger. And, you know, to go back to Cal Dietz's talk that he did at the Power Athlete Symposium 2019. 99% of all contact with this earth is through our feet. Therefore, if you have weak feet and you can't generate force out of them, everything up the chain is going to be like a marshmallow. So first thing I wanted to do is start and try to make their feet as strong as possible, which you would kind of think for jiu-jitsu guys that are constantly barefoot and all the different movements they do. but actually they had a ton of just laxity in the foot. So wanted to really use those eversion boards to create more just
stiffness.
Stiffness is
a great, use a training term.
Yeah, is the excellent term for it. The other issue we got into, because they're so dominant one side, like one side always do this, they have muscle imbalances. So the first thing I had to address is the muscle imbalances between the legs. And the only way you're going to do that, you know, we can squat all day and we can do all these bilateral hip hinging different movements, but we really had to go into some unilateral stuff to challenge posture and position and really start developing strength. That's why we went to a majority of dumbbell bench and a lot of single arm dumbbell bench and just a ton of dumbbell stuff to try to really maximize and try to identify some deficiencies.
Yes. And asymmetry, extremely common in all sports, baseball, golf, football, tennis, football. And so now our assumption was it didn't exist within this sport. But then our observation between the deficit between right and left, oh, there is asymmetry within this sport. Yeah. And the more we learned about this sport, the more we're able to now identify limitations and utilize a weight room to turn them into superpowers.
Yeah, the mistake that I made, I looked at like a wrestling model and, you know, having listened to, you know, Gable and some of those other guys like the Brand Brothers talk about conditioning and training and wrestling from that point of view. So I had an appreciation, obviously, for the wrestler and just like the psychoticness and just the fact that these guys are so highly trained and just so physically dominant in terms of their conditioning. And what was interesting with jiu-jitsu is there's a lot of really breaks and it's much more patient than something like wrestling. So thinking that, you know, the training and what they were doing within the confines of the school or the gym or just within practice was enough to develop their aerobic capacity. That was a huge mistake by me early on. And then we realized that we needed to start incorporating a bunch of GPP work and really just a base level of conditioning and developed what I call the superhuman protocol.
Yes. And majority of the normies out there that use jiu-jitsu as their conditioning, that's a mistake, especially as we level up and enter into the professional realm.
Yeah, well, just even having rolled, you know, a few days a week with these guys, especially in their general pop classes, it's pretty interesting to see that guys are using jiu-jitsu for their conditioning and their training, when in reality, it's way too technical. And, you know, at the very end, we might get 3 or 4 rounds, 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, you might get 15 minutes of actual roll time. It's not really enough to develop a base level of conditioning that's needed. And the one thing that's apparent, especially for guys as they start to age, I just see a lot of overuse injuries and a lot of stupid things like strained abs and shoulders and things that could be really fixed if they just lifted weights a few days a week, did a little bit of zone 1, zone 2 conditioning, and then use the jiu-jitsu to necessarily test and as their skill development.
Yes. And the interesting thing is the more skilled you are, the less energy you use.
Yes.
So it becomes a less and less conditioning tool. Maybe it starts out that way.
Yeah.
But similar to our experience with regular sports and seasons, the first 2-3 weeks, it's a grind. No matter how hard you train, you're not in football shape. You're not in basketball shape. You're not in lacrosse shape. So then you get more efficient. You use less energy. You know where you are on the field or the court. So now the more you know you are way around the mat, I'll say, the less energy you're going to use. And so now it does not become your conditioning.
That's the hallmark of the master. You know, as you ascend in belts and you get up in the belts, your ability to be very efficient in your movement and not waste movement and to understand like, hey, I'm here. This is a advantageous position or a not advantageous position, how to reverse it and put yourself into the most efficient position possible where there's no wasted movement. And
saying the seamless and effortless movement through space by the combination of primal movement patterns is also utilized in jiu-jitsu?
Yeah. And even to more extent, when you start talking about different planes of motion and, you know, you're on your back. So, I mean, we really look at it for, you know, let's say we talk about football, you know, the ability to seamlessly and effortlessly combine primal movement patterns X, Y, and Z through space to accomplish a novel task. The one thing that rarely happens, and if it does in football, and this is something I wrestle with, and metaphorically, no pun intended, every single day is me laying on my back with somebody on top of me. So for those of you guys that aren't pro football fans, the single worst place for an offensive lineman to be is on your back with somebody on top of you. So that's how I go home. That's how I don't have a job anymore. So I have to like almost lie to myself, be like, it's okay that a guy's laying on top of you and we start in this position. So now you think about the orientation. I mean, normally we're in this kind of vertical orientation on our feet, trying not to get knocked down. Now here's something where you're laying on your back and you're moving 360, you know, supine, prone. I mean, all these different positions, and you're having to, you know, rely upon your ability to manipulate your body in relationship to another person. So it's a very open loop in that respect. But then also you find the limitations within your own body very quickly. I was blessed with excellent hip mobility. So it's the only thing I got. You know, I got a chip in my knee. I'm limited range of motion on my right knee. But what I've done is I've made up for it by having really good hip mobility, which I credit the dead bug with. I have come to the conclusion just watching.
So it's not blessed. You worked very hard for it.
Well, I like to think working hard is a blessing. I think being granted determination, effort, and a blindness in focus is a blessing. It could be a curse too, but that's a blessing in a lot of ways. We've done dead bugs because they were an isostability test that we used to assess people when we taught the CrossFit football seminars. We use it with all of our athletes. We use it in all of our programs. So where do we use it? We use it in our own training, and we've really put it front and center with our fighters, and we'll do the dead bug with them, you know, almost every time. To try to challenge them and push them and show them different patterns. The one thing that I've noticed from the dead bug is not only is my hip mobility much better, but that was just kind of something I thought I always had. It wasn't until actually Arash recently and some of the other guys that we worked with for Drake's Fury talked about it. They're like, I feel like I'm walking better. I feel like when I stride, I can actually move better. So we've actually seen the effects of the dead bug on proper movement when you're upright.
Well, the origins, it's spinal rehabilitation.
Yeah. So learning Dr. Gasser.
Yeah. Learning to walk again from the ground up.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Gasser used it as his test after progressing people from spinal surgery. Like once they could master the dead bug, what he didn't like, and we've grown to hate as well, is when they do the dead bug with the feet or the knees bent. And by keeping the legs straight, you can check hamstring flexibility and then also dorsiflexion, which becomes extremely important
daily. Yeah. So it's a daily assessment, especially I like it for field court sport athletes, because I can tell an imbalance between right and left.
Yep.
What calves are tight, what hamstrings are tight. How did my training affect their ability to get into a good neutral position?
Yep.
And then adjust accordingly. Speaking of adjusting accordingly, I want to stick with the slant boards.
Yeah.
And the observation. So lack of stiffness, recalling, maybe there's a solution with some quote unquote imbalance training and injury prevention.
Well, when we were doing some basic plyos, and I've always really, I've felt for a long time that the bridge between the gym and the weight room, or, you know, the field and the weight room, I'll use the gym, I mean, in terms of the mats, but really the bridge between the sport specific and the general specific or general physical preparedness. I mean, you know, really the bridge there happens with the plyometrics and especially the jumping and a lot of the dynamic movements you do, whether it be the med balls, the plyos, any of the stuff that we do that looks like compensatory acceleration or requires them to move in space. The one thing that was really apparent was the lack of rigidity within the lower foot. And that's where I had to dig back. And as I was sitting there thinking on it, I remembered my science and practice, pulled it out, got to page 168. And sure enough, there was the picture that I was looking for. Ooh, sorry. So with the eversion boards, and talks about developing rigidity in the feet, especially for plyometrics, and not necessarily having them land on it, but using it as a platform at which to jump. So we started incorporating this in all their plyometrics, and we started using it with trap bar pulls. We didn't necessarily use it very much with any of the squatting, even though we have for some a little bit.
Kettlebell swings, so we're hinging.
Yep. But we didn't like it for the squat just because the technical nature, especially with...
Yes, and they were still learning to squat. Yeah. So their weight room experience prior to this was very limited to machines or just, we'll call it just bro lifting, hanging out. Oh, I worked out for 2 hours, but half of that was on your phone.
Sure. So we started incorporating this, and what was pretty amazing from doing it, all of a sudden that rigidity increased, and then things like change of direction, moving through space, just some of the things like jumping rope you know, some of the movement med ball stuff we do, all of a sudden dramatically improved. The other interesting thing, we've spent an entire almost decade teaching people to put big toes in the ground and then drive their knees out so that the knees still track over the instep so we can engage the glutes. What I found was interesting with the boxes, especially in the poles, it automatically set their knees and their feet and their...
For these individuals. So, and then the direction, we've been, yes, teaching to press your toes down. And then if that individual needed a knees out direction,
sure,
then we applied that cue. But the aim is neutrality and forwards,
yep,
which in the squat, which helps prepare for change of direction.
Yeah. Well, the knees need to track over the insteps.
That's the key. Yes.
The reason being is when you go change direction, and the reason we teach the barbell back squat the way we do isn't because it's the most efficient, best way to squat, which I believe it is, but there can be arguments whether or not that maybe it's not the ability to squat maximal weight. Maybe you can squat more weight another way, but it's a reinforcing the pattern that we need for you to most efficiently change direction. So we're using the barbell back squat, that form of hinge, as a driver for efficient, safe, explosive, fast change of direction.
For transfer to the primary audience in which we were coaching was field court sport athletes.
Yes.
So this is an introduction now to specificity. How we were coaching the movement was specific to the athlete that we were preparing and their why, their what they're training for.
Yep.
So now leading in with specificity and then the target of identifying a limitation in stiffness and asymmetry within these guys. And then the WEC board's introduction that John no longer had to coach knees out because this put them in an optimal position.
Yeah.
So this is all in line and speaking to specificity, which in power athlete work realm is that transfer of training to the goal, the mission, the mat, the field, the court.
Yeah, no, I mean, the various bars and the implements and the different exercises that we use are piece of this specificity training, where if an athlete can't do something or they're not able to execute something well, we have the ability to pivot to different movements. And let's give you an example. If there's a shoulder impingement and we can't get into a good position to barbell back squat, then we move to something like the kabuki bars.
But we change the implement. The movement doesn't change.
No, it's still a squat. Squat is a squat. Right. We just need the athlete to do his best squat. And I'm not going to get slowing down and spend a ton of time messing with a bunch of shoulder impingement that could never abate. I'm going to just change the movement or the implement that allows for a more true movement, like let's say like the kabuki bars. You know, another issue we run into is on the deadlift. You know, it takes a while to teach people how to deadlift, especially going around the knees. For some reason, the minute the bar gets to the knees, we get some amnesia. And especially coming down, they bend their knees too fast, the bar hits them on the top of the knees. So being able to transition to something like a trap bar, which is actually kind of a different movement, more akin to the squat than actually a deadlift.
Depends on the execution.
Yeah.
So, and the position to hips.
So we started using that a ton in their max effort pulls, just because what it did is it forced them to keep their hips back and drive back, opposed from just shoving their knees forward. And when you do that on the trap bar, the bar swings back and all of a sudden pins you into a strange position. So we were almost using it as a canary in the coal mine. So as they went to pull, as the hips stayed back and they pulled, almost driving back into. The joke I always make is, imagine you're at a bar and you want to push your hips back against somebody, throwing out the vibe. Same deal. If you shove your knees forward really hard on the trap bar, the bar is going to swing and you're going to get into a bad position.
Yes. So also applying accommodating resistance to help reinforce the bar path.
Yep.
So these guys, they walked like a duck.
And we called it jiu-jitsu feet.
Jiu-jitsu feet, and they're very anterior dominant. So very quad dominant within their movement. So say the trap bar got too heavy, then instead of using their backside to pull the bar, their knees would drift forward and they would rely on their quads to do the primary mover.
Yep.
Where we want them to be posterior chain dominant in this. So aiming to even them out. So then using accommodating resistance band around the feet and the bar, it forces them to utilize the posterior chain.
Yeah.
So all of this is a representation of specificity, and shameless plug here at powerathletehq.com/academy. We deep dive into all of the things we're speaking on right now, especially especially the specificity. So three components of transfer to training that, John has introduced and we're covering right now. The first is external structure. This is our body position, how we want to set up a movement. Then very important is the internal structure, how all the happenings inside, the muscles, the tendons, the joints, how they align and execute. So we have the setup and then the execution, the internal structure. And then last but not least, the force production. We need the force production, how they move and express through space to be representative of the demands. We're not going to do slow and grinding stuff for our football players who are very, very explosive and dynamic. Yeah. So it's a matter of execution. Now for the fighters, we, and John did a great job of really immersing himself in the sport to understand how they need to apply different forms of force and to our normal setup and execution in the gym.
Yeah, the biggest one was grip strength and hand strength, especially with these guys doing a lot of no-gi work. In the gi, there's handles and there's a lot of grip training done. I mean, I could think, you know, we're doing a bunch of closed guard stuff and you're constantly grabbing the gi and like you get done and your fingers are, that's where some kadaya killers
help. My fingers hurt.
Oh, your back's going to hurt, old lady. But that's where I start doing kadaya. People are like, what do you do with your fingers? I'm like, kadaya killers, trying to balance it out. But as they transition back in the gi, which Victor just got done fighting down in that BJJ Stars 16-man shootout, we needed to get a ton of work in the grip and the training. So we started using not only heavy kettlebells for the swings. Well, you know, we have 100, a 150, a 203. So we started doing a ton of that type of stuff, but also a ton of manual resistant pull-ups, a lot of single arm rows, and just everything we can do to
really force.
Yeah, sandbags. I have fallen in love with sandbags again. There was some time and probably, I want to say circa 2012, 2013,
is that when
14.
Zach Evanesh beat you in the sandbag challenge?
Did he beat me? We might have to reboot that one. I'll have to reboot that. But we put out the sandbag challenge, which was 30 clean and jerks with 135 pound sandbag.
And, it's yeah. Essentially, was that Grace?
It was Grace, but Grace. Zach didn't go ground overhead. He did ground
Zach's
to shoulder.
Zach's interpretation of ground overhead.
Yeah, was just ground to shoulder.
Right.
So now if we would redo it, it would probably be ground to shoulder toss.
Right, over the shoulder.
Which we've, instead of just going ground to overhead with the sandbag, what we've asked the guys to do now is scoop the bag and throw it over their shoulder. And they have to clean, it has to go clean over the shoulder. They can't roll it over the shoulder.
They can't. I can.
Yeah. Well, you can. I'm not training you for BJJ Stars.
Picking up 150 down a pound, just little man to toss him. That's what I'm training for.
I love it. My first introduction to sandbags came many, many years ago at CrossFit Newport. Kelly Starrett texted over this workout that was called Texas Cardio. And it involved, I want to say it was 10 ground power cleans with 135 pound sandbag, 10 step ups right with 135 on the shoulder, 10 step ups left with 135 pound on the shoulder, and then a 400 meter run with the 135 pound sandbag. So the power cleans weren't easy, were fairly easy. The step ups were extremely difficult. All of a sudden you take off on the 400 meter run with the 135 pound sandbag. I got out to the 200. And then as I was coming back, the sandbag fell off my shoulder and was on the ground.
Sure. You just didn't drop it.
No, it legitimately just slithered off. I'm bent over. I'm sweating. I'm looking at this bag, trying to mentally gather myself is the right word to get it back on my shoulder. And a dude pulls up in a truck and he's like, "Hey man, this really looks terrible. Do you need some help? We could throw it in the back of the truck." Just some Mexican gardener dude just trying to be friendly. And as I look over with just the death face and I'm like, "Fuck you," picked it up and ran it back. And I think it was 3 rounds. And that was really,
this is in the Feel Strong density cycle, which is a sandbag cycle.
Yeah. Which is a sandbag cycle. So at that point I fell in love with sandbags. And they would work periodically into the CrossFit football. They would work into Power Athlete. And when we started training the fighters, the way their templates kind of evolved has really been into, and I'm just going to tip a hat to Louis Simmons on this one. A lot of max effort, but we don't do a lot of singles. Really, the training is dictated by the superhuman protocol. So the max effort kind of hit their big lifts. We do a lot of manual resistance, a lot of heavy movements. There's going to be reverse hypers, a lot of med balls, a lot of heavy kind of rotation with transverse, also frontal plane and sagittal plane. And then Wednesday is our dynamic day, which involves the plyometrics, compensatory acceleration, more plyometrics, more med balls, and just moving fast. And then Friday comes out, and Friday's straight up strongman. Mm-hmm. This is going to be heavy, awkward, suck. And the sandbags have worked their way back into my heart to the point where I look at them and I get excited. I'm like, let's scoop these things and throw them. The other day, what we did is we set up a little circle, threw a bunch of the bags in the middle, and you pretty much had to clean it up, take it, and then throw it at the next person. And then that person had to clean it up, and we went around and we did 30 reps, and we went to a heavier one, 30 reps, and then a final heaviest one for 30 reps. And that was some good team camaraderie.
Yeah, and we were picking on poor Philippe for that one. Now, let's get into the superhuman protocol. Mm. You've mentioned that twice. What are we talking about here? Is the world ready?
No, they're not ready. And I've kept it under secret, under wraps as I've been testing it.
Double secret probation?
Oh, it's really secretive. I have an ally in Tom Newman to kind of bounce stuff off of. But this superhuman protocol, I believe that if you can meet the demands of the superhuman protocol, your conditioning will be so high that you will never gas. And the only thing that I'm worried about is where do we go after the guys hit it? Because they hit it. They were able to reach the final level for the superhuman protocol. And now we have to go back and just continue to do some testing like we did yesterday. And it's been really fascinating, especially with the supplementation of using the mix of creatine and beta-alanine. And now all of a sudden incorporating vitamin D. And then we got a pretty good,
let's stay on track with the superhuman protocol. I'm going to lead us there. Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah. So it involves an echo bike, and we've been using the echo bike because there's no eccentric load and it's very difficult to damage yourself. And it's also, there's no technique in it. You just set the seat at the right height. Biggest issue we found is finding what seat height is most advantageous for each athlete. I like to keep my knee obviously lower than my hip because I want to just be explosive on the push that last little bit. So I get the seat as high as possible. Other guys like the seat a little bit high or a little bit lower, but they can't generate as much force. Really it comes down to, and I'll just kind of throw it out there. I mean, it's a series of Tabatas, but we have a very real protocol in terms of how and what numbers you need to hit to be consistent, to be able to progress your Tabatas. So obviously everybody's familiar with just eight. But what we end up doing is once you hit the protocol.
For those that are not familiar, we got 4 minutes yep. of 20 seconds of work, 10 seconds of rest, repeated eight times over 4 minutes.
And then there's a 4 minute rest. And then if you were able to hit the milestones and the waterfalls on the first set of Tabatas, you earn one more Tabata, which is number nine. If you hit the numbers on number nine, then you earn 10 through 16. Then you get a 4 minute rest. You'll test 17, and if you hit the waterfall in 17, you earn the rest. And if you're able to maintain not only those numbers and the protocols and really the waterfalls and milestones that we've set up, and you amass 24, then you've officially reached superhuman protocol.
Yes, and this 1, 2, 3, that's not going to happen on the first try.
No.
If you hit it on the first try, you didn't go hard enough on set all out. Numero uno.
Well, we know what the max effort set. We know the numbers. So I know based upon your body weight, what I've seen you do in the weight room, what your capacity is, I have a number that you need to hit in my head. And I know that if you don't hit that number, you're sandbagging because we know what elite looks like. We've tested ourselves. We've tested with the fighters. I know pretty close about what each person should hit. And if the numbers super far off, then I know you're sandbagging. And then also if your subsequent follow-up rounds are too high, then I know that your peak. But then what's also interesting, and this is where I get into kind of pushing this out, is the protocols have really driven the training. So for example, Victor and Philippe, their peaks are through the roof, right? And their repeated efforts are not as high as they should be. Rosh's peak wasn't as high as it should be, but his repeated efforts are really high. So as we got into this, that's where I started doing more fours and sixes with Philippe and Victor and more doubles and triples with Rosh, trying to get his peak strength up. But the interesting thing, I think it was a technique issue with Rosh, because he hit 1290, 1300 on his max peak. Victor and those guys are anywhere from 14 to 15, and Victor's in that 15 to 1600, which is pretty elite. Especially when you're using the Echo bike minus the Turbo Shield. So for those of you guys that have the Echo bikes, no shade on Assault. We still have a ton of Assault bikes. They gave us a ton of bikes years ago. We've rebuilt them. We've used them. We've broken them. We've rebuilt them. We've rebuilt them again. We've broken them. We've rebuilt them. And they're great to have. But Rogue came out, and I'm not a Rogue fanboy by any means. We got a ton of Sornex. I'm not paid for this. But that Echo bike is mandatory. If you're doing power athlete training and you got a couple hundred extra bucks and you want to order something, order that Echo bike.
A couple hundred.
What are they like? They're like between what, five and 700? I think they're five. I think they're like seven.
Seven to a grand.
But you can find them used. I see them used all the time on Facebook Marketplace. I saw one the other day for 580. I should have sent it to you.
You should have.
I should have. So, I mean, they do pop up, but we use it so much, it's pennies on the dollar. And the fact that they don't break, they're built like tanks, the seat's comfortable. I mean, in the amount of time and effort and money we've spent into rebuilding all of our Assault bikes, we could have purchased more Echo bikes. So at one point, we'll just clear it out and go all Echo bikes. I just haven't got there yet.
Yeah. And I mean, the all-out effort sets, we're trying to break those things.
Yeah, and we have been able to. And we got big, strong athletes hitting as hard as we can for repeated efforts. So the Superhuman Protocol has really provided a ton of direction and allowed us to really, almost choose your own adventure and how to skin the training. The other interesting one is, especially for athletes, something like jiu-jitsu, there's a lot of banged up knees, backs, and shoulders, and guys are constantly dealing with stuff just because the volume of work they do is so high. On some days they do, they roll in the mornings, they do wrestling practice at lunch, and then they roll again at night. So they might be on the mat for anywhere for, 3 to 5 hours. And then they come in and they do our training. And then at night or first thing in the morning or late at night, they got to do some form of zone one work just because we found that it helps with heart rate variability and just recovery. So they're getting multiple training sessions. And the one thing that becomes clear is if I need some form of max effort or we're doing something dynamic or whatever it looks like, and there's an injury that's a limiting factor, instead of just like, moving away from the training and not doing it, we just pivot. So, if Victor's back or shoulder feels beat up and we can't squat, we're going to go to belt squat. If, that becomes an issue, we need to work on something, we'll use the trap bars. We have different bars from a cambered bar. We get kabuki bar with different settings. We can squat to boxes. I mean, there's a million different forms of hinging that we can do within our X axes. Especially the big one too, where I've seen a ton of dividend. And if you guys follow power athlete programs, I'm a huge fan of the Bulgarian split squat. And the reason I enjoy it and the reason that we have such great success with it is that we do it than anybody different in the world does it. We have a setup where the back knee has to be behind the glute and it has to stay behind the back of the glute, or it has to stay behind the glute because we're fighting for hip extension. And the only way you're ever going to get hip extension, and just standing up and pressing your hips through the top isn't hip extension. Hip extension happens when the knee is behind the glute. And the way that we coach, and Kelly Starrett as well, forces athletes to get into hip extension, which allows not only a stronger, more stable, but also a more flexible and dynamic hip. And the way that we've done, especially with the awkward loading, with chains and kettlebells and dumbbells and weighted vests and all the different ways we've done it, have really forced the athletes to stabilize and be able to keep fighting for that hip extension.
Yes. And this goes essentially the value, the perspective, the coaching, the experience that we apply across the board to all movement. So it's not just the Bulgarian split squat, but that's the theme. Yeah. We don't just, hey, this looks good, or, oh, this, and have a template for training and say, oh, this is a form of hinging, or this is a unilateral leg movement. Let's just throw that in there. Nope. Here's the setup. Here's the execution, here's the why, and then we coach you through it to the best we can online through demo videos, coaching points of performance, and then from the desk of John Wellborn, guidance on the setup so you get the execution the best you can from what it is in our head.
Yeah.
So that's the training experience. That is specificity as we can get it across.
Well, the so when I was sitting at Sornex Summer Strong years ago, and Cal Dietz was up talking about their training and was showing some videos where they do with their heavy Hatfield single leg squats with the active foot.
Yeah.
If you watch that movement, that back knee is behind the glute the entire time. So they're using the active foot driving the weight, but the active knee or the knee behind the glute forcing hip extension for their movement, basically getting them into that position, which is more akin to sprinting and the position they need to be most successful for athleticism. It becomes very specialized in that they needed multiple spotters. I mean, it's a whole fucking circus to make that happen at a weight that is acceptable for it. So looking
For those Division One team sport athletes. Yes.
I mean, Cal Dietz is a wizard, and what he's looking to do is, he's got 10 coaches that are extremely prepped in this, trying to take a little bit of that. And how do we translate that into somebody who's training in their own garage without a, cast of characters to support them. So really just focusing on those movements, making sure that they're getting positive knee angle, getting the knee over the big toe and leaving the glute or the knee behind the glute and forcing hip extension, which I think is another factor for developing that hip mobility that we were talking about early on. I think we've been doing this so long that it just becomes second nature to us. But what's really neat is to bring in high level athletes and put them initially into our training model, force them into all of these things, these points of performance, and then seeing them, 5-6 months after the fact, seeing the amount of improvement has been anything short of just fantastic. Just the grip stuff, as a Rush and I were rolling yesterday, just feeling his grip on the lapel. And normally I can break anybody's grip, but all of a sudden as Rush is holding me, I'm like, shit, his grip's really strong. And to the point where some of the people that rolled with him were like, dude, are you taking drugs or something? Your grip is astronomical. And he's like, nah, dude, it's been all this crazy ass grip training we've been doing. So, then there's also something I wrestle with every day is
you're on fire with these puns,
man. There's like 10,000 things I want to do. So I have this like catalog of things that I want to incorporate and things I want to do. But once you get into the gym, I think about what can we do well and what do we have time for and what's how to maximize efficiency. I don't want these guys stuck in the weight room for 3 hours just because I have an ego and I want to incorporate and I want to try this and I want to do this. My job is to get the greatest return for the minimal investment. If I can get them in and out of the gym with the warm up in 70, 75, 80 minutes, and that involves our conditioning and warm up and movement and everything, and I can literally hammer them and push the conditioning, really just that base level, and get them out to do what they need to do, which is effectively be efficient on the mat, then that is the goal. I think sometimes we have this idea that, all of this stuff I want to try in here, and the athlete has 3 hours and I'm going to do this and this and this. And you have to remember, they don't get paid to lift weights. They get paid for what they execute on the turf, on the field, on the pitch, on the jiu-jitsu mats, whatever it is. That's how they make their money. That's how they make their hay. So my job is just to sharpen the blade, make sure that they're strong, stable, that they move through space well, that we address imbalances. They can generate force both in a transverse, frontal, and a sagittal plane. They're strong enough within their grip, nice and stable, and they have the base level of conditioning where if they got to go fucking hard and they got to hit the energy button and they got to fucking push it, they have that extra gear ready for them.
On fire with these principles. That would be an example of accelerated adaptation. Mm-hmm. Only have so much time. Got to give it to them. And they have different specialties within these. I'm talking jiu-jitsu guys. Oh, I guess this applies to all sport. So the jiu-jitsu guys, they have wrestling, they have their BJJ coaches, and then they have their careers. They need to make some money. So all of those are pulling from all different directions away from weight room time. Mm-hmm. And then in other sports, you get your quarterback's coach. Then you got your offensive coordinator. And then you have to, all of these coaches want to pull, and then your strength coach. Only so much time that you have for the training, and coaches are very selfish. So they aim, and I think the sign of a great strength coach is, okay, we got X amount. We're going to do as much as we can in this small window of time to put you in the best position to be well coordinated and durable for all the other coaches. You did mention supplementation that these gentlemen were taking, yep. And you have some fun research that one of our Block One coaches, Hunter Waldman, is executing. So let's get into those supplements.
Yeah. When I use supplementation, I'm not talking about steroids or drugs. I really think especially in the BJJ community, that guys are taking a ton of steroids and a ton of drugs to make up for a lack of training knowledge. So if you have a shitty program and you don't know how to strength conditioning, you can make up for a deficit by just taking drugs. Not to say those guys aren't working hard, but it becomes just an easy bridge, a faster way to get there than doing the fucking work. And so when I'm talking about supplementation, when we started doing the superhuman protocol, I found that if they were taking 5 grams of creatine morning and night and between 3 and 4 grams of beta alanine, and then also maximizing vitamin D levels, all of a sudden they were anywhere from 10 to 15% better on their peaks. And their repeated efforts were much better, to the point where I can see the peak in like 1 or 2 repeated efforts and know if they haven't been taking their supplements. So then we have a long talk about not only diet, but supplements. You're basically, you're cheating me and you're cheating the training by not doing what you need to do to be able to maximize output. The other one, and we got it from Tom Inkledon when we did that supplement review. Is that in January or December?
Well, recorded in December, released in January.
Tom mentioned krill oil as a better option for putting on muscle than fish oil. And Hunter Waldman, one of our PhDs, is doing some research in his lab and found that astaxanthin, which is the component that makes krill oil have this effect, is pretty incredible and also has a great synergy effect with creatine. Bill Williams, one of our hammer guys, one of our block one coaches, he listened to Tom's podcast, started taking krill oil, went back to get his eyes checked recently, and his eyesight improved. So I guess there's carotene flavonoids somewhere in there that improves eyesight. So, I mean, there's some really amazing stuff we've seen it. So that's another thing we're throwing in the superhuman protocol, which is going to be krill oil or the direct form of astaxanthin, which I think is called Astraline or Astra something. So, but to the point where when, you know, I pulled up some research that found that guys that are from countries around the equator, like Brazil, for example, when they come to countries like America, where they're, you know, we're here in Texas, there's a lot of sun, they historically have low vitamin D levels. So going through Thorne, getting their vitamin D levels checked, they were low. They were in the teens and the 20s. So then supplementing with vitamin D.
What should it be?
Hopefully in the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
So we want their vitamin D levels to be as high as possible. So we dosed them with a ton of vitamin D, and all of a sudden, like magic, the performance went up. They weren't dragging. They felt better. Everything started going up. So really just the mix of creatine, beta-alanine, vitamin D, and now with this astaxanthin through the krill oil, we're seeing a really good synergistic effect. And I think mix that with, you know, the fact that these guys are young. They're in their 20s. So they're made of rubber, unlike some other athletes that are made in their 40s who remember what it was like to be in their 20s. But it's really helped in terms of their base level conditioning and the effort and the sustained effort that they're putting in. I mean, they're doing such a high volume of training. My goal wasn't to replicate what they do on the mat, right? I know what they did on the mat. I wore heart rate monitor. I know exactly what their mat looks like. It was about maximizing recruiting motor units, making sure they're efficient and stable, like we talked about, fixing imbalances and making sure that we're sharpening their blade. So when they go out to use it out on the mat or the field, whatever it is, they're as efficient as possible. It's been fun too. The other one I was blown away with, they can't jump rope, but dude, you kick those guys a soccer ball and they're going to make us look stupid.
Yeah.
So we have ropes. And a soccer ball.
Yeah, we deflated all the soccer balls and then added more jump ropes so we look cooler.
Yeah, so we have jump rope skills. Those guys don't have jump rope skills, but what I did is every Friday we have a jump rope competition. So I got them jump ropes. They have to jump rope on their own. They have to practice, and then they got to come in and show their razzle-dazzle for 5 minutes. And the winner on Friday gets to take home the Elk Order Award, which is a gold Jesus necklace that I got out of a swap meet in California. That's probably made of plastic, but it looks like the best player gold you've ever seen. And then they get to wear El Gordo for the week as the winner of the El Gordo challenge. So just trying to have fun, trying to bring some lightheartedness and a little bit of like, we're not in here curing cancer. We're in there trying to make high level athletes that much better and put them into a training environment that's both fun, competitive, and something that they can see the effects. I know this sounds crazy. I used to see people do a ton of work in the weight room and I didn't see it translate on the field. I always wanted to feel like every single day that I was getting better And the things that I was doing in the weight room were translating on the field. If I got stronger, could I punch harder? If, you know, we increased something within, you know, step, squat, and lunge within the jumps, if my jumps got better, if I was more explosive, if I was moving through space, I wanted to see their receipts on the field. And I felt like I did that for the majority of my career. And I want those individuals to come out and be like, dude, I wasn't tired. When I put my meat hooks on somebody, they weren't getting away. When I put the vice grips on them, I was able to choke them. All of those things, I want to see the receipts. And I want to see that what we do in the training translates very well to the athlete in their given sport.
Yeah. And also, it's a matter of reinforcing behavior. Or, excuse me, behavior for all these guys. Because in the beginning, the jiu-jitsu individuals, they do a hard set and they'd sit down for, I don't know, 5 minutes. So now introducing what hard work and training is for this limited 90-minute window that we do have, we're not wasting any time.
Yeah.
Now, to apply that to others, different sports, guys that are working hard in the gym, but then maybe doing bodybuilding splits. So if they are working hard for 2 hours, you want to reinforce that behavior, acknowledge their hard work, but then introduce a more direct athletic style of training that has more transferability. Yep. So there are guys that are working hard. It may not be the best program for the sport in which they're training for.
Well, I mean, the majority of guys, either they're running their own strength conditioning or they're going to Flex Magazine like I did when I was a kid. You know, they're just doing straight up bodybuilding.
I'm not mad at that.
A lot of slow eccentrics. One of the six blade guys up in Dallas, Tiago, came down and trained with us. And Tiago looks like $1 million bucks and super strong, like a fucking boa constrictor. You know, his training, very bodybuilding based, a lot of slow eccentrics, constant tension, you know, high rep sets, 10, 20, 30 reps, never a lockout, just constant slow, slow, slow. And it's worked very well for his style of jiu-jitsu. I just think that, you know, watching the ADCC and the, you know, the fact that they're bringing in wrestlers, you know, just Matt, you know, my training partner who wrestled at Cornell, we were watching Gordon Ryan versus Bo Nichols. So Bo Nichols was right out of college before he got into the UFC, and they did a wrestling match with Gordon. And, you know, in wrestling, if somebody goes to drive into you and you step backwards, you do that 3 times, you lose the match because it's called stalling. So all of a sudden he gets in there with Gordon. He's used to Division I wrestling. What does Gordon do? He just keeps running out of bounds. So for 28 minutes, he did this. And then at like the last 2 minutes, he gets him, you know, Bo Nichols goes for a takedown. He leaves his arm out and the dude gets him into an arm bar. But you have Bo Nichols, who's a collegiate wrestler, one of the best of all time. And, you know, he's never done submission wrestling. He doesn't know any of that shit. He just knows how to like pin a dude. So then he's gone on and done very well in the UFC and taken a lot of that just fuck you that you get with a lot of wrestlers where, you know, it's just this constant. This push to never
forwards.
Lose. Forwards. Yeah, forwards. So you can't step back. And I think that was pretty interesting to watch that against Gordon, you know, who's considered the best grappler in the world. And you have a situation where he's using the rules and, you know, they're set up for him, but you put him against a high level wrestler. I mean, he would have lost that in the first 2 minutes of that match to be able to go forward. So I have a lot of appreciation. It wasn't necessarily something I was that cued in on just because. You know, more of a football fan. You know, I look in that, but now that we've gotten more into jits and then also Matt's coming over and been my training partner, he's constantly sending me all these different videos and different clips of different wrestlers. And it's just taken a little bit to see the appreciation of not how hard those guys work, but then also there's a real good wrestling academy, 3F, here in Austin that once Cashy gets about another year older, he's going to get dropped off there. So it's been important for those kids. I think wrestling, and I regret not wrestling in high school. I should have done it. I got kind of buffaloed away and, oh, you're going to lose weight and you're not going to be able to put it back on in this. And I kind of got pushed away from a little bit, but that was a mistake. I really think.
We'll save football politics for another podcast.
I'm telling you, man, there's this idea and, you know, back then it was an idea. Now it's a practice. I think things start as like an idea or a whisper and then they grow into this, like just this practice, like, you have to be specific so early on. You have to identify what sport you're going to play. And I really think we do our kids a discredit by not forcing them to do everything. You know, I used to box. We did martial arts up into a certain age. I played football. I ran track. And I really regret, I mean, I played basketball, played baseball, and then I really regret not doing wrestling. It just wasn't very big in California. I remember ice hockey was another one I wanted to try, but there was no way my parents were getting up at 4 a.m. to take me for ice time.
Or 9, 10 p.m.
Oh, yeah. There was no way. But I had a buddy that played, and his parents were psycho enough to like to have to get him up and drive him at 4 a.m.
Well, hockey moms.
Yeah, they're into it. But then you have, you know, if you live in Minnesota where Cal Dietz lives, that's just the norm.
It's Saturday morning.
But that's what everybody does. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a little bit of geographical to where you're from, Southern California, play football.
A lot of it.
But, you know, it's like in Brazil. You know, like these kids either play soccer. If you're not good at soccer, you probably go do jiu-jitsu.
Foosball.
Yeah. No, it's futsal.
I know.
Futsal, a little ball. But it's, I think we do our kids a terrible disservice, and we see it all the time. I mean, Cash is playing baseball at 7, and these kids already have a travel team.
Yes. And we would be in the camp of the physical character development through the weight room over summer, maybe, rather than the travel ball.
Yeah, but if you look at the world's best athletes, you know, I listened to a podcast pretty recently with the brand Terry and Todd Brand, who are the wrestling coaches at Iowa. The one brother won a gold medal in the Olympics. The other brother, I think, won bronze. They were talking about, he said at about fifth grade, 10 years old, he became obsessed with wrestling. And he studied it. He watched it. It was all he wanted to do his entire life was wrestle. And he's like, I got bit by the bug. And like, that's never changed. I still am obsessed with it. It's all I want to do. And I think that's so rare these days. And he even talked about how rare that is, that they don't find that like they used to. And there's this kind of lure of just Iowa farm kid wrestlers who are just absolute savages that won't quit. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, that's what we cultivate. That's what we do. And that's who we recruit.
Yeah. Lacrosse has it. We spoke to Marcus Holman on the podcast about that. And this was my comment when we got into the specialization. Like, he, as a college coach, was recruiting what's known as a lax rat. That's, they're obsessed. All they want to do is play mm-hmm. around.
But as a kid like Marcus Holman, is he going to recruit this lax rat? Or would he want a kid that can do, you know, the kid's a running back in football and can do all these other things. And then it's better to take somebody who has this base level of athleticism that can move through space and just has all these different.
Depends on the position. So as an offensive minded individual like Holman was, who's not, I mean, he's athletic, but he's not the biggest dude out there. You probably want more of a skill.
He's pretty fucking athletic. When we watched those videos, holy shit, this kid can move through space.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's one of the best in the world. So then if your skill can make up for your lesser athleticism, okay. Then if we have an athlete that's also skilled, you jump all over that kid. But then there's amazing stories, like one of the Atlanta Falcons wide receivers. He won the award, the lacrosse Heisman, if you will, for he's the best lacrosse player. He still had a year of eligibility. He went and played quarterback for a Division II team and then worked his way onto the Atlanta Falcons as a wide receiver.
Oh, shit.
Bernhardt. His father was an NFL coach. And, his brother plays in the PLL, the Premier Lacrosse League. So it's very athletically gifted family.
Yeah.
So now it's
he comes from good stock, as my mom would say.
But he's a representation of the multi-sport athlete that had success, where lacrosse is just an afterthought because football was his passion. But he got the scholarship. He won the Heisman for lacrosse. But I'm going to continue to follow my passion. It led to the NFL. Mm-hmm. Could he have gone that route if he just said all in football and gone and walked onto Ohio State?
Sure.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Nobody knows.
It's pretty interesting in the NFL. If you're a good player, they'll find you. I mean, I played with a ton of guys that were Division II, Division III players that all played at a high level. And, you know, maybe coming out of high school, they didn't have the accolades or just the optics. You know, it's different now today, I think with social media and just, you know, recruiting and YouTube and all the other deals that like, there's just so much opportunity that if you're a good player, I almost wonder if there was something back in the day where coaches were like recruiting phenoms, because they would find these players that were just, nobody knew about them, and they would come out of nowhere. And I got this guy who's coming in, he's going to be great. And the guy ends up being great. Whereas now there's,
yeah, there's no hiding.
There's no hiding.
I just remembered the old recruiting tape story that you were telling.
Yeah.
Dude's highlight film at a party.
Oh shit. Oh yeah. I'll tell you a good one. I'll even tell you the guy's name. So I got recruited to go to UC Berkeley. We had a guy, Jason Sharp, comes in, and he's a receiver from Losinger, which was in our league. So I played against him, and all of a sudden, they start handing out scholarships, and all of a sudden I look at the recruiting class, and Jay Sharp's on there from Losinger. And we played against him. I didn't necessarily know him or remember him, and I was kind of surprised, because I was LA Times lineman of the year, and I went to all these things, and he wasn't necessarily at any of this stuff, so you kind of knew who the players were. So all of a sudden we get to college, and I see him, and he's kind of a little undersized. I'm kind of surprised that they recruited a dude that small, but good dude. I mean, could play. And my freshman year, we're all in the dorms. And, on Fridays, guys would want to drink beers in their dorm rooms. And so I go over to a couple of the guys' room, and we're sitting there drinking beers, and they start wanting to throw on their highlight tapes. Dude, show them your highlight tape. Throw on the highlight tape. So Jay Sharp, doesn't want to throw it on. And they grab it and they put it in. And all of a sudden I see it fire up. And as I'm watching, Losinger's blue and white. Hawthorne is red and yellow, and all of a sudden I see the game, and I'm like, oh, which one are you? They're like, that's number four. And I'm like, that's not Losinger, that's Hawthorne High School, and that's Curtis Conway. So he had effectively somehow been sending
sending in
highlight films. And these dumbass coaches didn't recognize Curtis Conway played at USC. And the reason I knew it was Curtis Conway was because they were playing Palos Verdes High School, and my brother was in that game. And so I was at that game he was in. I was a spectator as a little kid, and I remember Curtis Conway running all over PB. And that was one of the highlights, and they were showing Curtis Conway. So these dipshit coaches we had, somehow they reached out to the coach. Somebody sent them highlight, and he was number four for Losinger. They never showed up to do their due diligence, and he ended up getting a scholarship. A year later, he was, he either got hurt, or I can't remember what happened, but he ended up not playing football anymore, and they gave him a medical scholarship. And so he got a scholarship to go to Cal. I don't even know if he graduated. I don't know why I lost track of him, but he ended up scamming the system, which you could do back then, right? Because did they show up? I mean, did they do who did the due diligence? I mean, and I think once he got there, they realized, shit, this ain't the dude we thought he was. And then instead of just being you lied, fraud, they just give him a medical scholarship and push him out the door.
Yeah, and there's another story. I can't recall it 100%, but there was an offensive lineman who just told this big tale to his family, to his school about recruiting, and they set up a recruiting day, and he did the whole hat selecting thing. I think it was Oregon State. It was either Oklahoma State or Oregon State. Pulls up the Oregon State, and then they're like, no, never heard of you. So it was a story that made its way to ESPN because this kid just committed some big lie.
Oh, he said that, that these schools had offered him?
That didn't offer him. And he made a selection for a school that I don't even know if he applied or got into.
Oh, shit.
But just... damn, lie that just went too far. But your guy, he benefited.
He pulled it off. Well, man, they so for my recruiting class, this is what's interesting is we had a quarterback that came in on a scholarship, a guy named Trevor Thompson. Trevor was all world in high school. His senior year takes a bad hit. I forgot what he played. Maybe he was I know he was a quarterback. I don't know if he played on defense, but basically got hit and landed with his hand over his head and basically blew out his shoulder. So they cleaned his shoulder up and played him, and he was coming back. And they ended up, all the other schools, every school dropped him. Cal ended up honoring the scholarship, and he ended up coming to Cal. He never played for us. He was never able to get his shoulder right. And he kept talking every year, hey, I'm going to put on 20 pounds. I'm going to play defense, and I'm going to help you guys. And just never did. And I always liked Trevor. Thought he could have been really helped us. If he would have put on weight and played defense, because he was fast. He was a good hitter. He's an incredible athlete. He just you know, either he was there, wasn't going to get rid of it. Who knows? But yeah, he, that was another guy we had. We had another guy, Bruce. I can't remember Bruce's last name. So he and Kevin Doherty, who was also my roommate, they came from Atascadero, and Bruce legitimately had an 800-pound squat in high school, set of reps and a belt, and squatted 800 in high school at like a body weight of like 245, 250.
Video?
Yeah. They had it on video. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen. I mean, the dude was an absolute fucking beast and ended up injuring his back, had his back surgery, never came back. And that was another kid that we had that probably could have gone and played in the NFL. I mean, was so strong and so explosive and just, you know, injury. So, I mean, there was
training or football injury,
football injury. So on the field, I mean, you know, like I played guard in high school, and the tackle I played next to was a guy named Matt Redmond. Matt was like 6'7", like 285, 290 in high school, which is fucking huge. He was huge. He actually went to Iowa, got a scholarship. First day, senior year of, hitting practice, the way my office, or so, well, my head coach is dead, but that doesn't change the fact that he's an asshole. Gary Kimbrell, first day, you know, the first way he wanted to get Oklahoma started on our first day of hitting was he took the two biggest guns and you fucking faced them out against each other. So we're standing there getting ready, first day hitting, Oklahoma drill. Everybody's in a big fucking circle, calls me out against Redmond. And I come off, take a zone step, and he was taller than me, but he basically first day of hitting, you know, everybody plays high. So he took a step and stood straight up. I kept my pads low because I'd been training all year, and came off the ball and hit him and got underneath him. And all of a sudden his feet fluttered a little and I went to finish the block. And as I finished him into the running back. The running back bounced off. He stumbled and I buried him and he ended up hurting his back and herniated a disc in his back on that play. And they walked him off the field. He was never right again. Ended up going from Iowa. He took a medical scholarship. I think he's a history teacher somewhere out there. But yeah, my fucking head coach was such a douchebag. Just was a jerk and never liked me. But I also came from PB. It was a different place.
I've heard that before, John.
Yeah, didn't like me. And I still started both ways. So
That's different than the stories of, oh, he didn't like me, so he did not play in me.
No, he legitimately said, I don't like you, but you're the best player we have. So, yeah, I mean, poor Matt Redmond, man. He herniated a disc because a coach wanted to try to get everybody all fired up and do this stupid Oklahoma drill, which for those of you guys that are listening that played football, Oklahoma drill, pretty much you take an offensive lineman, defensive lineman, you get down, you have a linebacker, and you have a running back, and you have a whole bunch of dudes standing just right on the side, like making like looks like train tracks. And there's a big kind of square semicircle. Everybody's there. And all of a sudden the ball gets hiked. The linemen come off, you hit. And as a defensive lineman, you want to try to shuck the offensive lineman, take on the running back. And then the linebacker fills. I was playing D line, drove him back right into the running back, and basically like running back bounced off. I caked him, and then we got a fucking basically tackle for loss, and the whole place was fucking over and we were dancing and doing crazy shit. Oklahoma drill has probably ended more careers than people it's helped. But I mean, football isn't football without Oklahoma drill. So did you guys do Oklahoma drill in high school?
We did. Yeah. I can't say I was a star of any of that show. But
yeah,
we did it.
Oh, it's kind of a rite of passage.
We did it in middle school football. So stupid.
I can't believe that y'all played middle school padded football.
Yeah. Middle seventh grade on's fine.
I didn't
play until seventh grade, but then there was my boys, they all played like peewee leading up.
Yeah. None of those guys play football anymore.
None of them play football anymore.
Colin Mooney was the only one. He played at that age?
Yeah. Oh. Pittsburgh Steelers was like the Katie Taylor team. So everybody played together. I did not. Hmm. But yeah. He's the bright shining star. This year, around our podcast time, during football season, he was honored into the Katie ISD Hall of Fame.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite podcasts we've done this year.
Oh, he's awesome.
Yeah, he's such a nice dude and such an intelligent cat. But to kind of take this back a little bit on a Q1 review, kind of an AAR a little bit of what we've done at Q1 with the training programs. you know, for Jack Street, we finished up all these different just fun cycles, a lot of density type stuff. And right now we're getting into what looks like a little bit of peaking, in that we hit a lot of singles, doubles, and triples, just for the fact that we have done so much work. I wanted to see with a little bit of testing what people could handle. And the numbers coming out of Jack Street are phenomenal. Like, people are strong, they're moving. And what's cool is I set up Discord for Power Athlete. And what's been really a lot of fun, we got about 180, almost 200 people in it now. A lot of the fire breathers and the people that are constantly posting and just live and die with this stuff are really just providing a lot of good content. One of the clicks on Train Heroic is that the feeds are team specific. I've always wanted a Power Athlete specific feed. Just because I think there's guys on Hammer that can help Jack Street, and there's Jack Streeters that can help Field Strong, and I wanted to kind of melt the two, and they just have never provided that level of tech for us. So I went outside, created a Discord. If you want, you can just jump on any of the programs, look at the team feed. I post it every couple of days, or you can hit us up. But it's been having a Power Athlete specific team feed of training, and the amount of training content, footage, and just the stuff that I'm getting is fucking blowing my mind. You know, Power Athlete, in terms of the training programs, is providing as advertised, and I just don't know anybody that I think is doing. I mean, if people are doing it better than us, I want to see it, just because I'm not seeing it and what other people are doing. And man, it's pretty amazing, just the progress and just the numbers and just the dedication of what people have. I'm pretty inspired by it. So I think that's been a lot of fun, you know, kind of getting that rolling in Q1's been great. Hammer has been really going. They actually, we finished the entire alpha codes. So we had to start back in alpha, and now we're back to alpha and Bravo. So they're working on Bravo right now, which are just basically the 2.0 version of the initial cycle and what I've learned. So what I've really taken is the feedback and what we're doing in our own training and seeing what people are doing and just trying to create the best experience that I can. And you know, at the end of the day, regardless of what the sets and the reps and all that looks like, consistency and perfect execution of movement are really what's trumping everything.
There you have it.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And the one thing I'm excited for too is, if you're not following the methodology, we got a reboot coming. I finished all my writing, so I'm pretty damn close. And I got to provide those to techs. We're going to get our next, would you say, the next version, the next evolution, the 2.0 of the methodology?
Well, I suppose we can get into it quickly. The first was the level one, and we had a grandiose vision for these different tiers. And then gifted 1 year of coaching an athlete to everyone, which then lead to the next level. And level two would have been 1, 2, 3 years. So like the life cycle of a high school or a collegiate athlete. So then we reorganized and vamped. And now the methodology, instead of levels, we are offering just this essential 4 years of training one athlete for the price of one. Yeah. So now much of what we talked about now, specificity, different programming approaches and principles and coaching techniques, dialing it in for 4 years of coaching one athlete just in one online course. Yeah. And guidance to take you through that. So that's I'm pretty excited about it. PowerAthleteHQ.com/academy, amongst other micro courses that are branches off of the methodology.
Yeah. So we got to get this one put to bed. I'm super excited for that.
Well, by the time this comes out.
Yeah, it'll be out. And then if you decide to take this a step further, you become a Power Athlete certified coach, what's commonly referred to around here as our block coaches, and because they earn blocks, like you see right there, when they pass. And we have our annual event called The Collective coming up in September, which I'm pretty excited for. It's shaping up to be a lot of fun. We're going to do a private BJJ event with Victor and Shanji. So we're going to get that in. We have a ton of other special guests that I'm going to keep under wraps for now that have already confirmed showing up. So it's not only the events about education, getting together with other block coaches, but it's also about having some really pretty amazing people. Last year, Kelly Starrett, Chris Duffin, Derek Woodsky, Roth was there. So just being able to rub shoulders with some of the best in the business and be able to have, you know, good dialogue and really just have a lot of fun and get to train and then go out. And we also have a new space for the venue. In years past, we've gone down to Mercer Street and got a band. After connecting with Judd Kaufman, we're going to take that to Desert Door. So now we got to maybe get a liquor sponsor. And I'm pretty excited for that, dude. That's shaping up to be a lot of fun. It's always great to see all the coaches. And I feel like now, too, through this Discord, good amount of our Block 1 coaches are in there. It's really interesting to be able to have that level of granularity with their training. I mean, these guys are posting content every single day, and I want to start reviewing it a lot more on the social. So
thank you for another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.